Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, happy Monday, everyone, and thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill. Before we get started with today's show, I'd like to take a moment and thank our sponsors, the folks over at Markham Search, LLC. Markham Search offers premier professional recruiting services throughout the United States, and they offer a variety of services, including payrolling services, temporary services, executive recruitment, and retained search. So please keep Markham Search in mind for all of your recruitment needs. Today we have with us on the show, Michael Ventura. Michael is the CEO and founder of Sub Rosa, a strategy and design firm that has worked with some of the world's largest and most important brands, organizations, and startups, ranging from Johnson & Johnson, Pantone, and Adobe to the TED Conference, Delta Airlines, and The Daily Show. Michael has served as a board member and advisor to a variety of organizations, including Behance, The Burning Man Project, Cooper Hewitt, and the UN's Tribal Link Foundation. He is also a visiting lecturer at institutions such as Princeton University and the United States Military Academy at West Point. In addition to these pursuits, Michael leads a thriving indigenous medicine practice where he helps patients address illness and injury of all types on the road to better well-being. A passionate entrepreneur, he also owns and operates a globally recognized design store in New York's West Village with his wife, Caroline. Applied Empathy, his first book was published by Simon & Schuster in May 2018. Thanks so much for joining us today, Michael.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about this journey. How does somebody go and become this instructor and speaker and advisor and also owning a design store in New York? How did this all come about? How did you become an entrepreneur?
Yeah, I think it's probably masochism at some level. The way it started for me was I graduated university in a recession, and this was back in 2002, and I had a hard time finding a job, ended up working at an ad agency for about a year, and then was laid off when they did a round of layoffs and some downsizing, and found myself 23 years old and 1 year of experience and not much else on my resume. And friend of mine who was working in financial services at the time was ready to get out of there. And the both of us said, well, look, we know enough to just be dangerous. We've both spent a couple of years in the working world, but there are a couple of things we're passionate about. We're passionate about fixing problems. We're passionate about digital, and we're passionate about sort of the way technology is being used inside businesses. And so we started our own quote-unquote consultancy at the ripe age of 23 and 24, respectively. Wow. And we started to work with organizations to help them think about how they could be a brand using digital and using social media at a time when it was still very nascent. And that has evolved and grown and taken twists and turns over the years. And the partnerships have dissolved and friendships have changed and things like that. And actually, that partner and I are still very good friends. But I've basically been an entrepreneur since then, taking risks and kind of following my gut.
That's just so incredible. I mean, so you hear a lot of people who pursue entrepreneurship after maybe 5, 10, 20 years in the workplace, but just start fresh out of school. Were there any fears of failure when you first started?
Absolutely. I think that's probably one of the biggest motivators for most entrepreneurs is the fear of failure. And so for me, that was a form of, let's call it, productive anxiety that was a motivator, that we had to keep going and keep challenging ourselves. And actually that partner's father early on when we were getting started said something to me once. He was visiting New York and we were having a coffee together, and he said, if you don't get into trouble, you'll never learn how to get out of it. And it was such a nice reframing of the stresses of entrepreneurship, that essentially every decision and every choice you make is an opportunity to learn and to evolve and to, you know, don't get complacent.
Yeah, I think that's great advice because I think that's one of the things that there are a lot of fears and unknowns whenever you go out on any sort of venture to open a business, write a book, anything like that. There's a lot of unknowns. And I think it's about stepping out there and just knowing there might be a 1,000-foot precipice and you just got to jump out there and bring a parachute and hope for the best, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So tell me about this idea of applied empathy. I know this is a hot topic. It's something that people are very, very interested in at this point. What was it that had you go out and write the book and decide to make this your passion?
So 10 years ago, my current consulting business, Sub Rosa, was born. And we do a lot of work helping large organizations work through internal culture issues, helping them find vision and mission and values that are resonant, all of these sorts of big strategic brand and business challenges. And so we had been doing that work well for about 5 years, but we started to ask ourselves this question of, what's our special sauce? Is there something that really differentiates us? Is there something that makes our work unique? And we didn't have a good, clear answer. We knew we could do our work well, but we didn't know what was the underlying engine that was driving it all. And so we put together a project team and we said, let's be our own best client. And let's do the work that we do for our clients for ourselves. And let's unearth if there is some truth, something under the surface, let's figure out what it is. And as we looked at our best projects, the things we were most proud of, the way we ran our teams, we also looked at our least favorite projects, ones that were challenging, ones that failed. And amidst all of that, we looked for through lines. We looked for commonality. And the one thing that was true with all of that was when we were practicing empathy, when we were using empathy as a tool to step out of our own perspective and see the world from a different set of eyes and use that as insight to drive decision-making, solutions, design, whatever it was, our work was great. And when we ignored that practice, when we didn't do that sort of work, our work time and again was less effective. And so we realized there was really something to this, not just empathy, but the application of empathy, taking that understanding and putting it into work, that we developed a whole framework and a set of methodologies and all the things strategists love to do, right? You know, we've got tons of Venn diagrams and tons of different ways you can use empathy as a tool. And we built this toolkit and started to teach it at Princeton University first and then at West Point. And in the teaching of a full 12-week curriculum, we really refined the message and we refined the practice so that we could bring it into our clients' world too.
I love that. And you know, I find that empathy, it's like this thing. I don't know if you've ever studied ontology or the state of being. There was one of my teachers many years ago said that, what if we could all just be whoever, whatever we wanted to be? Like so often, Michael, we grow up and we're taught that you're shy because you don't interact well with people, or you're extroverted, or you're dynamic, or you're not dynamic. And I feel like we kind of live our life as though we have a preset amount of like, okay, well, you have just enough of this to get by. And I feel like empathy is one of those things that people look at and they say, oh, well, you're either born with it or you're not. Is that a made up idea? Or is that something that you think people can actually shift and learn to develop?
It's a topic we talk about a lot. I think that there is certainly a spectrum of capability with empathy, and there are certain people who are naturally inclined to have more of it and work with it more deftly than others. But that said, it is a innate human behavior. If you go all the way back to the sort of dawn of civilization and you look at how we as humans interacted, one of the things that's true across almost any civilization was storytelling, right? And the ability to put image and put word to a message and a story and to help people understand and be understood. And that is a very human desire. It's something I think everyone would, it would be hard to argue with the idea that you don't want to be understood better and that you don't want to understand others better, right? That's kind of just part of our natural curious DNA as humans. And so empathy is, we're wired for it, but like any other thing that you get good at it through practice. And so many people don't practice empathy on a regular basis. And so as a result, that muscle begins to atrophy, and then it becomes this mythos that like, oh, some people have it and other people don't. Well, some people practice it, a lot and other people don't also.
So let's talk about that. So if I hear what you're saying that yes, there might be people who might naturally be a little bit more inclined to be more empathetic than others. But like anything, if you practice it, it's something that you can grow. And if you use it regularly, for me, like Spanish from grade school, I can say hable español or hable inglés, but can't really get my transitive verbs right because I stopped practicing it years ago. Thus, the same is with empathy. If you're not practicing it regularly, you're going to begin to lose the capacity to be able to use it actively, right?
Yeah. And to be clear, there are three main types of empathy. And what we're talking about with applied empathy is only one of them. So I'll explain them very briefly because I think it is helpful for people. The first is affective empathy with an A. And affective empathy is what I like to think of as sort of golden rule empathy. It's I perceive that you're sad. I've been sad before. I'm going to treat you the way I like to be treated when I'm sad. Right. And within that is a folly, in my opinion, because you're bringing too much of yourself into the situation. There's a bias embedded in that. Right. What if when I'm sad, I want to be left alone, but when you're sad, you like to be consoled. I will be actually performing the wrong act with you because I will be treating you the way I want to be treated. Right. So that's affective empathy. And that's what most people think of when they think of empathy. And that's why there's this confusion around whether or not it has a place in business, whether or not it has a place in leadership, because that's not always the effective way to lead. The second is somatic empathy. And somatic empathy you'll find in situations like a spouse who's having sympathy pains for their pregnant wife, or nurses who are suffering empathy burnout because they're feeling all of the feelings of the patients they're serving every day, right? So somatic empathy is really hard to train. It's more something that just occurs. And again, really hard to kind of fit into business. The third type of empathy is called cognitive empathy. And that is really training the muscle of perspective taking. And that to us is what is the foundational type of empathy that applied empathy is built upon.
Okay, got it. So it's the last one is the one, the cognitive, I believe you said, empathy is the
yep.
one that you can really, control is the wrong word, that you can really embrace and utilize at any level, if I'm understanding you correctly, correct?
Yeah, and practice, I would say, too.
And practice. So can you give me an example of what cognitive empathy, how that would show up in a regular day-to-day business situation?
Sure. So when clients sometimes sit in a room and an organization decides that they're going to develop a new product. There's two schools of thought to how that typically takes place. Some organizations would say, we've been making widgets our whole business careers. We've got all the insights. You know, this person came from this manufacturer, this person came from that manufacturer. We all now work here. We know everything there is to know about making widgets. And the new widget, the version 5.0, is going to look and feel and sound just like this, right? And they'll go launch it, and maybe it's not terribly successful, and they'll wonder why. Another company might say, we've been making them all along, but there's probably a blind spot. There's probably something we're not thinking about. We need to go talk to people who buy these sorts of things. We need to talk to the supply chain. We need to talk to the media. We need to talk to all the different consumer groups that are actually out in the world consuming this. And they're going to take all of those insights and then bring them back in the room and lay them on the table and use that as input to design the next 5.0 version, right? Those are two
right.
very different approaches to solving the same thing. One is very insular and often navel-gazing and doesn't always put all the right data on the table to make the right choices. The other is time-consuming. Often laborious, sometimes frustrating, sometimes requires you to do things that you aren't ready to do or willing to do, but ultimately puts enough insight into the process that probably will get you a more successful outcome consistently time and again. And that's sort of the trade-off with practicing empathy a lot of the time is that it does take more time. I often tell people it slows things down before it speeds them up. You're going to have those uncomfortable conversations. You're going to have to try and go out on a limb to understand people that aren't like you. But if you do that, you're going to broaden your perspective to such a degree that you'll develop more well-rounded solutions.
I love that. So it's a funny thing that you just made me think about with respect to that, Michael, is whose responsibility is empathy in the business world?
So I like to think that it is a shared responsibility. I don't think that it's the kind of thing that can be centralized. I have been talking about this idea with a colleague of mine lately, and we're working on a research project to explore it, but how we're heading into an era where organizations really do need, in some ways, kind of like a code of ethics and a sometimes even like a intangibility expert, someone who's looking at all of the intangibles that make a business come to bear: the culture, its practice of empathy, its values, it's these things that are intangible but are so critical to understanding the world in which it operates. As a quick aside, I was talking about this with someone recently, and we were talking about a show that I loved to watch when I was growing up, Star Trek: Next Generation. And yeah. one of the things that is really interesting about that it didn't dawn on me until I was having this conversation is in the leadership team on the starship, there was an empath. It was one of the key leaders of the organization. How could you be a ship designed for exploration and not have an empath in your leadership team?
That's brilliant. I would have never put two together. It's so funny that we think that leadership looks a certain way. Like in some ways you think the devil wears Prada, or, you know, that CEO, right. What was that other one of the guy who wanted the money in the 1980s, that other Gordon Gekko, you know, those people who just make all the money and run the show. And yet you forget that the most successful teams have all of the different components, not just the person who's out there rainmaking or making tough leadership decisions. There has to be the equal weight to, well, what's going to be the cost and impact from an emotional or empathetic standpoint if we make these choices on our culture or on us as an organization?
Absolutely. And sometimes those decisions are the harder ones to make, right? The ones that are going to require retooling of an organization. We've seen it a lot this past 18 months with the rise of awareness and focus on diversity, inclusion, and equity challenges happening inside organizations, where, you know, there might have been a historical behavior that was causing some sort of imbalance in the diversity or in the inclusion policies of a company, but that's no longer tolerated in this day and age. And so sometimes the work that empathy shines a light on means that you're going to have to significantly change the way you do business in order to continue to be in business in the future.
Yeah, and I think it's so important, especially in service-driven industries, which at some level we're all kind of becoming service-driven industries, because years ago you didn't have things like Twitter where somebody could tweet to Comcast and say, I'm really disappointed and I'm no longer going to use your service. It used to be, okay, you know, you have a service or you have a product, but now it's available to the entire world at the click of a button, and all industries are becoming to some level service industries, and you have to really think about, what is the cost and impact of this choice, not just in this moment, but what are ripple effects and how is this going to impact future business as well as the clientele we already have or the people we already work with?
Absolutely. And because the talent pool in most of the major markets is also a little more transient. I think the average, it changes industry to industry, but like the average lifespan of someone at a particular employer is around 3 years, right? So if you realize that your talent is churning in and out of the business every 3 years, what are you doing to retain the top ones? And what are you doing to make sure that those folks will deviate from the norm of after 3 years switching to somewhere else? And empathy plays a big role in that. Do they feel understood? Do they feel like they have a clear career path? Do they feel like it's a place they want to come to work at every day? You know, all of those things are about practicing as leaders, practicing understanding with your team and understanding where they want to go and hopefully making an ecosystem where they can thrive.
Yeah, I think it's just a conversation that's worth having of how do we develop empathy and how do we identify our own empathetic blind spots as an individual or as a culture or as an organization? And how is it that we model new ways to be empathetic and new behaviors? I think that's one of the focuses of your book, is the 7 archetypes and different ways of modeling empathy, correct?
That's right. Yeah. So one of the things we wanted to create was a a tool that would be a bit of a gateway drug, if you will, for empathy, right? A way for people who, if you're not versed in this, if you don't practice this regularly, that you have something you can use to pull you into this process. And so we developed these seven different archetypes. And unlike other personality tests or assessment tests like a Myers-Briggs or a StrengthsFinder, which are great, but are diagnostic in their nature, in so much as after you take it, you know you are an ENFP and I am an ITSJ or whatever it ends up being. What we've done with the archetypes is to say, we don't want to diagnose you as one. We want to help you skill up in all, because if you can have the versatility to shift from a confidant, which is an active listener and someone who really is practiced at the art of listening and can signal and can operate in a listening state in such a way that people who they're listening to understand that they're truly there to listen and to hear what they have to say, they'll get more out of that person. To someone who's an inquirer, which really values the craft and the act of inquiry and of great question asking, and can use questions as a tool to unlock deeper and more meaningful understanding. Those are two of the different archetypes. You can start to understand that in certain instances, I've got to be a great listener. In other instances, I might need to be an excellent inquirer. And in the context of a team, you know, I was with a leadership team not that long ago, and we were doing this work, and we asked them all to self-identify their number one strength and their weakest archetype as well. And they went through that process. And what we unearthed was that they all, number one, self-selected that their best skill was that they were all great inquirers. They were great question askers, this entire group of a leadership team. And also uniformly, which rarely happens that you get like all on both strengths and weaknesses the same on a leadership team, but in this case it did occur, they all identified their weakest skill as being a good confidant, a good listener. And so we sat in a room and said, look, guys, this may come as a surprise to you, but the reason why your leadership team is not working so well is you're all great question askers, but none of you want to listen to the answers everyone has. And just shift their dynamic immediately. It was so obvious, but there wasn't a tool to point it out. And these archetypes gave them a tool to identify that issue that was lying right in front of them.
So what are the seven archetypes? I know you mentioned there was the inquirer, and then the confidant. And what were the other five?
Yeah, so there's the sage, which is really about presence. It's about signaling that you're fully in the moment with someone. You're not on a device. You're not thinking about what you need to do next. And the value that creates in the relationship so that people are willing to share more meaningfully and more fully. The confidant, we talked about the cultivator, is a big picture person. They see the point on the horizon. They want to know, they understand what it's going to take to commit to get to this longer point, and they can pull that into the now in order to help people understand where we're going and why we're going there. The seeker is daring. They're confident. They're unafraid. They take risks. They pivot. They know what it's like to come up to a precipice. They know what it's like to walk past it. They can use that to motivate others and to frankly motivate themselves at times. The alchemist is an experimenter. They're a prototyper. They like the act of failure and recovery. It's a way they learn. It's a way that they get other people comfortable with learning. Is that seven? I lost count.
I got most of them. I was just so enthralled in what you were saying as each one. I was just thinking.
Yeah, one other one hanging in the way.
You start to categorize people. I don't know if anybody else out there listening, I'm going, ooh, what am I? Ooh, who is this person? And you start to kind of think in your head and get lost in thought.
Exactly.
About it.
And that's the thing, I think, with any type of assessment, you know, everyone's been on BuzzFeed and found out, you know, what breakfast cereal they are or what Muppet that, you know, like we love to understand more about our makeup. And so this is a great way to give people a tool to understand not just where they have strengths, but perhaps even more importantly, where there are some opportunities for growth.
And is there a area, because it doesn't sound like, if I'm hearing you right, it doesn't sound like one archetype is better or worse than another. It's just to notice that maybe there are certain archetypes where somebody might exhibit 1 through 6, but be lacking, as the example you gave with the leadership team, in the 7th one. Is it more of a tool to kind of become self-aware and say, oh, this is the area of listening, where I really could be a better confidant? Or is it something where everybody naturally has all 7 and some are just stronger or weaker in those areas?
I agree with the latter a bit more, but I agree with what you said in the beginning too. It is an assessment and it does help you identify your strengths and weaknesses, but our goal is that everyone is all 7 just in equally distributed ways. And what we want to do is help people learn how to play to their strengths, but also dial up the ones that are a bit weaker so that they have the versatility that empathy requires. Because sometimes to really understand someone else, you might just need to be a good listener. You might need to shut off your natural strength and your natural tendency to lead the conversation, to steer it in a certain direction, and go into a state that is different for you or not as natural for you, but is actually what the person on the other side of the table needs in order to fully express themselves.
Yeah, I love that. And I think it's more integrative when you look at it that way. I feel like so often we make ourselves or others bad or wrong, or we try to categorize, but in some ways shaming or guilting the fact that you're not strong enough in this other area, as opposed to seeing it as a whole integrative being and saying, oh, okay, you know, and this is just something you could add a little bit more of this, or notice what each situation calls for as a unique expression of itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the type of versatility we ultimately want to create with this work, because as not just individuals, but as teams or as organizations evolve, the ability to be deft with the practice of empathy ultimately allows you to build stronger internal cultures, allows you to build more inclusive teams, allows you to bring insights from the world outside of your four walls inside the company so that you're actually thinking about things in a more well-rounded way. It's just got so many benefits.
Yeah, and I can see where that would be beneficial, not only on the company or the client side for somebody out there trying to land a deal or create a better company culture, but also on the individual side. If somebody is out there looking for a job, I would imagine that the most desirable applicant for the job would be somebody who could seamlessly weave their way throughout these different archetypes, depending on the style of the interviewer and the type of position that's required. If you were able to emulate each of the archetypes, you would be a more desirable potentially employee, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It starts to create that emotional intelligence that so many employers are looking for.
Yeah, I was just reading an article, I think, recently, I forget if it was Stanford or Harvard, that somebody had shared on LinkedIn, just talking about EQ and how employers are interviewing for the wrong thing. Everybody's very frustrated because they feel like, oh, why are organizations not working? Yet we're discounting people too quickly in the interview because we're not paying attention to the EQ and to the empathy and to the soft skills, and we're too focused on the hard skills. Do you have a good pedigree on paper? And we're missing the diamonds.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's never 100 and 0, but I do believe that soft skills are the sort of thing that are foundational, and hard skills, of course, you need them to get the job, but also hard skills can be grown and can be developed over time. Not that soft skills can't, but if you're looking for someone to come into an organization straight away and be a contributor, often someone with high EQ has a higher likelihood of that than someone who has low EQ but high IQ.
I love that. Well, Michael, it's been a pleasure. I think you've given us a lot of food for thought and, you know, definitely piqued my curiosity about the archetypes of myself and those I know and get a chance to work with on a daily basis. So tell our listeners a little bit more about, you know, what it is like. Where can they find your book? Where can they get more information if this is something that interests them?
Yeah, so the easiest place to start is applytoempathy.com. There you'll find, you know, links to the book, some of the tools and frameworks we use are up there as well, so you can start to see them a bit more. And then also updates on any workshops and public speaking events and things like that, that both myself and my colleagues are doing, because we're out there in the world very often running public workshops and workshops for organizations and teams to help them try this stuff on and to kind of see how it feels and ultimately, you know, build it more into their own internal practice.
I love that. And were there any, if you could give our listeners one thing to maybe take away from today's show, or something that maybe I didn't get a chance to ask you, is there anything you'd love to leave our listeners with from today's show?
Yeah, I would say don't be intimidated to just start practicing this in some way, in some small way. Talk to someone you don't talk to usually. Ask some questions that make you a little uncomfortable. Have a deeper conversation instead of a superficial one with a colleague. Don't ask them what they did this week, that weekend, maybe over a cup of coffee. Ask them about their family. Ask them about what it was like growing up. You know, go one notch deeper into inquiry and exploration and trying to see the world from someone else's shoes, because that act will start to build the comfort to do it more often.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think it's so true. And the energy, it's funny, one of my other favorite podcasts that I listen to is called Weekly Energy Boost with one of my mentors, David Guillem. And I think it was this week they were talking about the energy of this week is to kind of break free and do something you've never normally done. So if this week, to tie in exactly what you just said, Michael, is just ask one question that you would normally never ask to anybody in your life, and maybe have that be the one uncomfortable thing that you do all day, and just practice counting as you listen to somebody. I know it takes practice for those of us who might not be as good of listeners. I know it's a skill I'm personally always working on, but what if you just ask somebody a question and then you just count it and you just let them just continue to see whatever came up, and not just try to jump in or add your two cents or have a good counterpoint to it, but just really practice listening as long as you could possibly do it and see what kind of comes out of that, just as a way to play around with it this week.
Love that.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Michael. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show today. And thank you so much to everybody tuning in, whether you're tuning in now or down the road listening to it at a later time. Hopefully you found this helpful. I know I certainly did. If you missed any portion of today's show, of course, you'll be able to find it on the latalkradio.com webpage under Channel 1, Get Yourself the Job. At the bottom of that page is an archive of today's show, as well as all prior shows that we've done over the last 3 years. And you can also find it later in the week on iTunes under Get Yourself the Job on iTunes. Please feel free to leave us any feedback, rate us. We also have a Get Yourself the Job page on Facebook where we're sharing other articles, and we'll also share recaps of the show or links to the show in case you missed it. And so we definitely invite you to engage with us and whatever feels good to you. And thanks again for everybody who tuned in today. And thank you to Michael.
Thank you.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.